We made this.
The TARDIS Crew, a Doctor Who podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm Baz Grand, and my co-host in this venture through time and space is my son Ben. How are you, Ben?
Yeah, fine, decent, normal stuff.
Yes,
usual.
Yeah, going for your GCC mocks at the moment. It's a lot of stress, but Doctor Who is a time away from that, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Brilliant. So we're not alone in the TARDIS this time. Joining us to talk Doctor Who are authors Andy Frankamallen, Tim Gabriel, and Chris Lynch. Welcome to the TARDIS.
Hello.
Good to have you on. So in this episode, we'll be talking about Brigadier Alistair Lethbridge-Stewart Unit, the Lethbridge-Stewart spin-off series of novels from Kanjar Books, and the more recently announced Unit Files. And there you go, there's Andy there with the book showing. It's audio, so no one can see it, Andy, but you are showing the book on screen.
I'm just helping you get the name right.
Yes, yeah. Lethbridge-Stewart, yes. But before we get into that, we'd like to delve a little deeper into each guest Doctor Who fandom. So Ben has some questions for you all. Over to you, Ben.
Oh God, here we go.
Yeah.
I mean, to start off with, just the usual sort of questions people ask, like favourite Doctor, for example, first one.
Who is your favourite Doctor? Start with you, Andy.
All of them, of course. It depends on the mood, because everybody brings something different to Doctor Who, and I don't think any necessarily better or worse. The only thing that determines my likes or dislikes is usually the writing. So I know me and Ben are going to disagree on lots today.
Yeah, I think we will.
Yeah, I know you've listened to a lot of our podcasts already. And I think you tend to be more with me than Ben, don't you?
Time lapse is good.
We used to agree a lot, but clearly, you know.
Yeah.
Times are changing.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Well, yeah.
All is in flux.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, flux is quite good. What about you, Chris?
I tend to agree with Andy that it's different doctors for different moods, but probably the doctor's probably most favourite, but maybe most important in our house is Matt Smith, because that was the doctor that I started my twins on. So when they were like, oh, what's this Doctor Who thing? And we just felt that was a very accessible one to go with. So we went with that one and they absolutely loved it. But funnily enough, both of them now, I think, prefer Dave Tennant more. But the current most watched Doctor in our house would be John Pertwee, because I was laid up ill a couple of weeks ago. And because I was basically just on a sofa bed, unable to move except to activate the television, one of the twins thought this was the ideal time to watch Invasion of the Dinosaurs. Nice. And what's the one that comes before Invasion of the Dinosaurs?
Time Warrior. No, Time Warrior. That's the Daleks after. Never mind. Ignore me.
So, yeah. But weirdly, I have no problem with modern special effects, but like models quite freak me out. So the dinosaurs and Invasion of the Dinosaurs, I find really creepy.
They are so amazing.
Oh, it's the pterodactyl and it comes through the window and it's all like...
I find it quite funny how that story was originally meant to be, apparently the BBC going, we can do good dinosaurs, we can prove it, and then they did those.
They proved it.
It's certainly
the threat. The pterodactyl, honestly, if you look at him and he doesn't haunt your dreams, then you know you're made of sterner stuff than I am. But yeah, probably for us, it's sort of Matt Smith was my boy's gateway doctor. And so that's a special one in our house.
Good choice. Correct choice, even.
Oh, yeah. For you, it definitely matters with you, isn't
it? Oh, yeah.
What about you, Tim?
I'd change it from favourite to fondest. And that would be Tom Baker, who was the doctor that I started watching with and fell in love with as a very small boy. ridiculously young age. But added to that, the Doctor that I've missed the most when they've left is Matt Smith. So I don't know whether that means I have essentially a favourite from the classic series and the modern series or what. But yeah, Tom Baker's my fondest Doctor, and Matt Smith the one I've missed the most when he's left.
You know, I have never missed the Doctor.
No, I felt his job was undone. His work was not undone. His work, there was still more he could give to the part than could have done.
Yeah,
that's fair.
I mean, he was going to do like series 8, I think, was going to be just a series of him on Trenzalore, but then he decided not to do it, which he later regretted. Hence, Stephen Moffat like compressed it all into that one special, which is probably why.
That's such a wonderful thing to do.
I think you're the same as me, Tim. Yeah, Tom Baker's my favourite, and followed by Matt Smith. So, very similar taste there. Okay, next question, Ben.
Yes. So, I mean, Tim's already sort of answered it. But when did you guys first get into Doctor Who as a show? Fandom thing.
Me first again?
Cool, go for it, Andy.
All right, then. Alphabetical. When I was very, 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 very young. So decades ago. And that's all I'm saying.
Hard on, yep.
Oh!
Well, I've known Andy for a while now.
Not quite. No, honestly, the earliest I can distinctly remember would be season, whatever, 18, which would be Tom Baker's last. Although I would have watched it before that, but yes, I have very distinct memories of his last season. So that's kind of when I first got into it, but I drifted because obviously you become a teenager and an adult, and you sort of drift away from TV for a bit. And then I came back into it, bizarrely, with Time and the Rani Part 2. How that hooked me back in, I have no idea, but it did. And here I am. So
maybe it was just the bonkers nature of that story.
I don't know what it was.
Probably Kate O'Mara disguised as Bonnie Langford. That's probably what drew him back in.
That's
a hell of a lure.
That seems unlikely.
So obviously, Tim, so you said it was way back with Tom Baker as well, yeah?
It was. Unlike Andy, I've got memories of watching Doctor Who from when I was ridiculously young. So my earliest distinct memory is the end of the Deadly Assassin episode 2. That whole sequence after the Doctor's entered the Matrix, where he fights the samurai warrior, falls down the cliff, and then you've got the horse with the gas mask and the guy with the big syringe, and ends up with his foot trapped in the railway. All of that sequence I very, very distinctly remember, because I obviously I didn't have a clue what the hell was going on. I was very small, but the whole thing was just is indelibly imprinted in my brain. I remember lasers and probes being inserted into robots' heads in Robots of Death, the end of Talons of Weng Chiang episode 3, which I can guarantee there's no way a child of my age should have been watching that. And my mother kept repeating for years after how I'd screamed when the rat had got Leela, and she wouldn't let me watch the rest of that series. But I nagged her so much that she relented and let me watch again the following year. But it's insane. It really is.
Yeah. What about you, Chris?
I've been thinking about this, and it's a bit weird because I'm pretty confident that my first sort of Doctor Who memories are not Doctor Who on TV, but Doctor Who in books. So I can remember really vividly borrowing from the little village library where I grew up these kind of blue faux leather, kind of plasticky covered manual things, which gave you the really detailed breakdown of like how the TARDIS was built and how it worked. And copious, you know, diagrams of Daleks and K9 and such. And they had about three of them, and I took them out over and over and over again. And I can remember vividly sitting down, like, painstakingly copying these diagrams of sonic screwdrivers, you know, in the fear that I would take this book back and not be able to immediately renew it. So the first Doctor I can remember watching sort of in real time, I, you know, it was on and I sat down to watch it, is actually Sylvester McCoy. And I can remember watching that.
I'm the Rani, yeah.
So yeah, that's the first ones I can remember with Ace and all that stuff going on. I can remember those. But yeah, the first, definitely before that happened, in terms of when that would have been on TV for the first time, I was somewhere like the absolute cliche I am, drawing sonic screwdrivers and copying down like the schematics of K9 as if, you know, it would be at some point possible to build these things myself, maybe.
Did you ever try and build K9?
I did. I did make I made several cardboard canines, which were kind of a cardboard tube and then four little wheels and a head, and had the little set of keypad things on the back. Basically like a cardboard version of Big Track, but with a dog head. So yeah, no, I had a couple of cracks at that, but I failed to breathe true life into these creations. They remained dormant.
That's a shame.
So somewhere in a landfill somewhere, there's a cardboard canine showing, like, Father, why?
Why did you
abandon me? Why did you abandon me, Father?
Well, this took a dark turn.
Poor canine.
Poor Big Track.
I know.
Okay. So I think you've all been sufficiently indoctrinated into the TARDIS crew. So before we get into the Doctor Who spin-off novels from Kanjar Books, a question for you all, because we're here to talk about the Brigadier and Unit and Leffie Stewart. So what is it about Brigadier Alistair Leffie Stewart that makes him such a beloved character? Should we go for Andy first, and as you are the series editor of the series?
Okay. He's an icon. I think that's pretty much that straightforward. He's been around in Doctor Who for so long. You know, he was a recurring character for 8 years straight.
Hmm.
I don't know. He is intrinsic in Doctor Who, I think. I don't know. I don't know if I can describe it. It's like Doctor Who. How do you describe it? I don't know. I think it's just he's been there for so long. His character, or rather the way Nick Courtney portrayed the character, because there wasn't much on paper. There was just a dependability about it that, you know, just made a nice, solid, easy to understand character, even though you didn't know much about him really. But somehow Courtney's performance conveyed much more than a text. Mm.
I think you just want to be him, don't you? If something weird like that happens, like I know, you know, for all the sci-fi I've read and all this, I know if something like a Dalek came around the corner, I'm going to scream.
The brig.
You know, I want to be the brig. I want to be the guy who goes, okay, don't panic. You know, I'm just going to shoot it. I'm just going to deal with it. I want to be able to meet time travelers and dinosaurs and crazy aliens. I'm also going, I'm just like, yeah, it's fine. I'm just going to do my job and I'm rock solid. But in reality, anyone who knows me knows I'm going to lock myself in the toilet and just be, you know, just trying to avoid the entire thing. I'll have like put my out of office on. I just don't want to deal with it. You know, and I think that's what, particularly because I've sort of said, so I've been watching some of the John Pertwee ones recently. It's like, yeah, there's dinosaurs all over the place. He's like, yep, that's fine. Okay, it's just another day. Yeah, I think everybody either wants to be that type of person or have that person in their life, that just unshakable, unflappable character.
Oh, no. Not to burst your illusion of hiding in the toilet, but John Pertwee did once talk about finding a robotic Yeti on the loo, so you may want to check in there first.
Yeah, well, you always look under for feet. You always look under.
Yeah, don't want to see those clawed Yeti feet.
No, if you see the big furry feet under there, you just say, as you were, and you go to the adjacent stall.
Yeah,
and that did happen.
That's basics. If your dad's not told you that, I mean, that's basics. Check under.
Oh, I think Ben tells me that, you know, I'm a big Doctor Who fan, but I think Ben's knowledge is so vast that he will tell me facts that I never knew.
Yep.
Yeah. Andy, should you tell the story of when we first met?
And well, go on, then, if you insist.
Yeah.
Wow. So you had you were at a local library talking about the Companions book you released, didn't you? And
yes.
Yeah, all these kids.
2013.
Yeah. And yeah, Ben was 13. You would have been 7 at the time.
Well, it was actually in 2015.
15. Okay, so
I remember dates.
Okay, he doesn't really say. Don't question him.
So I'm a middle-aged man. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, 9-year-old Ben there, and he's got all his kids asking about Rose and Martha, and there Ben's going, well, in Big Finish episode this from 2005, what happened? Yeah, you would just go off on the whole tangent. Yep.
And Charlie Pollard this, Charlie Pollard that. Yes, yep. I remember.
Well, yeah. Actually, he did come back for Susan.
Yeah. And that's basically how I met, isn't it? Because of Ben. Because yes. Ben's knowledge was so impressive that we had to... keep that relationship up.
We did indeed.
Anyway, that's a bit of a digression. So, Tim, what about you? What was it about the Brigadier for you that makes him such an iconic character?
He's intrinsically a good man. He's not perfect. Just like, you know, nobody is. But he's good. He's dependable. He's not infallible. He will stand up for what he believes in. He's an excellent role model. I think in that respect, he's a reminder to an audience that nobody is perfect, nobody's infallible, but you just do the best you can, which is what he says in Battlefield. Yeah. You know, that's really sums him up for me. I've always got the impression that there was a lot more going on there than we see on screen. On Doctor Who anyway, and it's just been really good to have the ability and capacity to explore that. But that's what he is. That's what he is for me.
Yeah, I think it's Nicholas Courtney's performance, isn't it? Because he could have been a very...
Yeah.
I like his grounded pragmatism as a character, you know, compared to all these outlandish things that happen in the stories. But I think Nicholas Courtney brings such depth to that performance where he could have been very... very stereotypical military kind of almost adversary for the Doctor, but there's so much more to him with that in that performance. I mean, that's why he kept coming back, I think.
Yeah. Courtney wasn't originally going to be the Brigadier. Like,
no, he wasn't.
I think he was meant to be like Captain Knight in Web of Fear, but the person then originally slated to play the Brigadier, well, Colonel at the time, had to be fired or dropped out or something, so they bumped him up to the Colonel role, and then
it was here we are. David Langdon, that's it, David Langdon. Yeah, and he, yeah. I think he could make the filming dates, but he couldn't make the studio dates.
Ah.
So he that's why he was recast, and Camfield moved Nicholas Courtney up into the Colonel role and brought in Ralph Watson for Captain Knight instead.
I would say, and we'll have no way to know this for sure, but I suspect if Courtney's performance had not been so strong in Web of Fear, that he would have just been a one-off character and that would have been it.
Oh, yeah.
I just think
yeah.
that something about his performance resonated with Derek Sherwin and whoever was making it at the time and thought, actually, there's something here. Here we
I
are.
Think so.
Yeah,
I guess that led to them deciding to run the invasion as a test pilot for the Pertwee years and brought in the Brigadier and stuff.
Yeah.
And that still could have failed, but it didn't. So,
yeah.
I think that's Nick Courtney again.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I think you're right there. If Courtney hadn't been so good in the role, they'd still have brought in UNIT, but they would have introduced a new senior officer.
Maybe.
But yeah, it was perfect to bring him back. To offset that, I often think when we watch the Web of Fear now, which, you know, thankfully in the main we can, it's impossible to go back and to watch it with that same the innocence that the original viewers would have watched it with, because Lethbridge Stewart now has there's so much history to the character, what he became. Unless you're a completely new viewer to the concept of the series, you'll never get that that sense of, oh, is perhaps the Colonel the Great Intelligence?
Yes.
We lost that whole mystery, and it's such a shame, because I'd love to be able to watch it with that sort of innocent detachment. Mm.
You can't not know it's the Brig.
Yeah.
Then of course you're like, oh, really, another suspect.
Yeah. Who is this guy that's just popped in from nowhere? And he does a lot of the suspicious little things that Chorley and others do during that story Colonel Lethbridge Stewart is doing similar things, but we ignore it now because we think, oh, he's all right, he's a good guy. We, you know, he comes back a year down the line, he's heading up unit. But yeah, all of that stuff about when you know, Captain Knight goes, oh, well, police box, and he says, yes, we're going to go and find it, we're going to go and get it from Covent Garden. And it's fine to us now, and back then they must have thought, hang on, that's really suspicious. Why is he believing the doctor so readily? And all, you know, all of that, yeah, all of that stuff, which we lose unfortunately. Mm. You know, but I'd swap that any day for what we've gained.
Oh yeah,
subsequently.
Arguably, that also then leads to, you can now watch it in different eyes to those at the time, going, well, now we can see the birth of this character, we've seen progress and see what they were like at the start. But yeah, other than that, then, so who are your favourite unit characters other than the Brigadier, let's say?
Chris can go first this time. We monopolised that last bit. So
that's all right.
No.
Yeah. I've started to really like Benton at the moment.
Yeah.
Kind of like, not like an anti-Brig, but there's just like a slight, not cynicism, it's kind of like a, oh God, okay, yeah, all right then. You know, there's sort of slight world weariness to him. And I just quite like him. There's a bit where he's supposed to take the doctor off and imprison him, and he decides he's going to let him go. And he obviously needs the doctor, you know, the old trope of, well, you're going to have to knock me out so they don't, you know, so like they think you've escaped. And he's like, come on then. It's like, do your thing, do the thing you do. And then he gives him the old Aikido, the old Venetian Aikido. And it's, yeah, I've become quite warm to him recently.
Yeah, I'm a huge, huge Benton fan. I think he's this a lot of charm and charm to that character.
Yeah, Benton is great.
It's lucky, isn't it?
Yeah.
As it turns out.
Yeah. What about you, Tim?
Tricky. I've never really thought about it too much before. I mean, Benton's always been there, so he's another dependable character, isn't he? So I can't think of unit without thinking of effectively the Brig and Benton.
Yeah,
they're they're the two pillars that support the whole thing, and then you've got everyone else sort of moving around on top. No offense to Richard. Oh God, what's his name?
Franklin.
That's the one. No offense to Richard Franklin, but I was never entirely convinced by Captain Yates. I have to say, and it took me ages. I remember years ago when I was watching a lot of the stories for the first time, it took me ages to realise that he hadn't been in things like Three Doctors. So yeah, it really is. It's the Brig and Benton, but I also like that the whole setup that they have in the invasion, and I do think it's a shame that that wasn't carried over into season 7 with John Pertwee. So Captain Turner and Sergeant Walters as well. Captain Turner's got that rather overly pronounced sort of upper class captain quality to him. Sergeant Walters seems pretty sort of sturdy and dependable, a bit like Benton. And I think there was a good setup there originally, that it was a shame that wasn't carried over.
See, I was going to say Captain Turner as well, so I'll combine it with Captain Munro from Spearhead, because they're pretty much of a piece.
They are, yes.
As you said, they both got that very upper class dependability, but they also, in both their stories, have this bizarre, very bemused kind of like, all right then, fine, we'll go with this. Whereas the Brig's just like cynical as anything. They're just more bemused at first. And it's a nice balance. So I don't want to say Yates or Benton, because that's, you know, everyone knows those. But I think it's Tim says, it's a shame, for instance, that we didn't see more of Turner. I think that could have been interesting. But I don't know, maybe it's just rights issues. I don't know. Who knows? But yes, so Yates, Turner and Munro, definitely.
And I mean, as a child of the revival myself, while I do prefer, I think, the Brigadier and Benton, I can't help but also think of Kate and Osgood when I think about my favourite unit characters. I don't know. I just really like them as well. And
I like. I thought they were good. They were.
That's not unit.
It's unit 2.0, the science one.
Yeah, Ben to the moral generation here. Yeah,
come on. I like both.
They're UIT.
UIT. Okay.
I mean, technically, yeah.
Unified intelligence. So UIT.
UIT. Okay. UIT. The unit and UIT. Then okay. One more question about unit before we move on to the books. Then, so what are your favourite unit stories from Doctor Who?
Day of the Doctor. I'm joking.
Okay, serious answer then, Andy, if it's not Day of the Doctor.
I'd have to go with Spear from Space. It's just... It is probably... Although, actually, Spear from Space and Battlefield, I think they are the pinnacle of showing how a unit really could be.
Because Bambi was great.
You know, Battlefield, it was, I mean, I'd say probably since Spear, it's the first time we saw a unit being taken seriously. Because, you know, a unit does become a bit of a caricature of itself from season 8 onwards, which is fine. Obviously, it appealed to a lot of people because it became super popular. But for me, I prefer the more realistic key side of unit, which we saw in Spear and Battlefield.
Yeah.
And now you joking, Day of the Doctor, makes a lot more sense.
Hey, it could have been worse. I could have said Zygon invasion.
What's wrong with that?
I'm going
it's
to say
a good
Zygon.
Story, but there you go. But unit.
Chris, defend the Zygon. Yeah, come on.
I will defend Zygon invasion.
Thank you.
The thing that I like.
It's so good they had to get Clara to solve it for them. All right then.
Well, yeah, but it does suffer from Clara-itis. It does have that.
Maybe more Bonnie-itis.
Super Clara sort of factor. What I liked about it was I liked the sort of the globe-spanning nature of it, but I like the idea that as time moves forward and these things keep happening over and over again, eventually they have to sort of, they can't hold that line indefinitely and they have to compromise and say, right, this is what we're going to do. And it's a sort of an uncomfortable, difficult compromise where everyone has to move outside their comfort zone a little bit and say, well, okay, this is not what we wanted to do and probably not what the ethos of unit that the unit that we've been talking about would have done. And that's what I quite like about it. I like the idea that eventually unit have to say, or that, you know, Earth collectively in some way has to say, we have to give a little bit here.
Rather than the Brigadier just nuking the Silurians.
Rather than that, just constant holding the line and holding the line, and eventually it cracks. It's like, right, this is the best we could do. I like the feeling of kind of legacy in it, that they're dealing with problems, they're dealing with solutions from the past and saying, well, okay, we've now got this situation. And that felt very, I don't know, that resonated with me quite a bit.
Do you know?
I enjoyed it. And I like Osgood.
Yeah, you saying like all that. You saying all that makes me think that Harriet Jones would have been amazing in UNIT.
Well, I suppose that
she would not have taken their nonsense.
Most likely, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Tim?
I tend to favour the very early stories. Invasion, I absolutely adore the Invasion. I think it's an immensely well-plotted 8-part story. And I love Spearhead from Space and Ambassadors of Death.
I was just about to say, don't particular. Say that.
I love Ambassadors. Ben does not like Ambassadors.
You had to say Ambassadors.
Look, Ambassadors of Death is there's so much going on in Ambassadors of Death. It's almost like a pilot for a whole spin-off series itself. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And then it has the audacity to finish before the story's ended. The Doctor just walks out and goes, "Well, there could be another 2 or 3 episodes worth here, but I'm off. I'm going to go and polish my car
anymore. I'm done.
Yeah,
going to go. He leaves it for
UNIT to resolve, which is which is good. It's how it should be. It shouldn't be the UNIT relying on the Doctor all the time. It shows that UNIT is capable of resolving these situations itself, which is an empowering statement for UNIT at that point, because very shortly after that, really from Terror of the Autons onwards, it's the unit to a large extent seemed to be totally reliant on the Doctor solving all of their problems for them, which is a shame. But it's that in Ambassadors of Death, you've still got that vestige, that essence that Derek Sherwin was obviously thinking about originally from 68 onwards, when they were planning for Pat Tracton to stay and to try and relieve his workload increasing the cast of regular characters and changing it all around. And Ambassador's Death, I think, really is kind of the last throw of the dice for that. It's not necessarily all about the Doctor. It's about the group as a whole. Liz Shaw gets a wonderful adventure of her own to deal with as well. And okay, it's an adventure that involves her being locked up with Cyril Shapps and some radioactive guys. But still, it's not, you know, she's not standing there the whole time thinking, oh, what would the Doctor do? Or I wish the Doctor was here to help me. She's getting on with it.
Yeah.
This Ambassadors of Death is wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's why season 7 is my favourite Pertwee series, because, I mean, yeah, Liz is a great companion. She's my favourite Pertwee companion. But also, yeah, you see kind of unit in action as well. And coming off the immensely brilliant Invasion, like you, Tim, I adore the Invasion. But, yeah, there's some really great episodes in that seventh season as well.
A question for everyone then. Like, what does it feel like to take on the mantle of continuing the Brigadier's adventures in the Lethbridge-Stewart novels? Because obviously we've talked about how big a character the Brigadier is, and he's got a very dedicated fan base behind him.
Well, I feel at the end of the Key to Time, power, absolute power. Privilege? Not as in I've got privilege, I mean privileged. There was certainly way back when we began, 5-6 years ago, there was a sense of got to get this right. Because obviously, as a long-term fan myself, I was aware of the importance this character carries for many, many people. And, you know, in fairness, in much of TV Who, he was often shortchanged. Like I said, there was much to the character itself. It was all Courtney's performance, really. But it was important for me that we really got into who he was as a character. And anybody who knows anything about what we've done, I took my cues from a lot of non-TV Doctor Who, in particular stuff like Downtime, obviously, Spectre of Lanyon Moore, which we've referenced a few times, other books, which seem to have slipped my mind now. But yeah, it was kind of privilege, really, that we were able to do this and hopefully do it right, which it seems we have because people like it, so bonus. And no power at all, honest.
None at all.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I think privilege is a really good word for it. I thought this question might come up, and I was thinking about it earlier, and the best thing I come up with is it's a bit like you're getting to leave your footprint up on the moon, because obviously I write stuff with Kenny Jarman, with these guys, and I write other stuff as well. And when I'm working on my other stuff, it's not that it doesn't matter, but I have infinite option and changing and can kind of do anything that I want. And the guys have been massively gracious in terms of what I've done with my little bits of Lethbridge Stewart as well, and really given me a huge amount of free rein to do all sorts of stuff. But it just feels like, you know, you're working on one bit of the architrave in the cathedral, and Andy's over there and he's doing something else. And Tim is, you know, he's fixing something else, or he's building, you know, he's polishing up the font or getting that ready for this thing that is really, really matters to people. And I don't think that really clicked for me until my kids got so into it and I was able to show my one little boy found his way onto the TARDIS wiki on, is it fandom, and he was looking things up on there. which I, to my shame, occasionally have to do as well. And he was looking things up on there. And he found that I was there. And, you know, I was elevated to some all-new status in his eyes. But I think, yeah, that's what it felt like. It's being part of something that is much, much bigger. Does not actually restrict you, but sort of empowers you and gives you the opportunity to have sort of the best toy box you can imagine, if that makes sense.
Which is good, because when you're playing with somebody else's toys, which is essentially what we're doing, I think it challenges you in different ways. When you're writing your own stuff, there's much more freedom. But yeah. When you're writing a larger whole, you'd think it's more restricting, but it actually just challenges you to discipline yourself in different ways, which, you know, Baz has learned this, obviously Tim's learned this, Chris has learned this, now he hasn't worked with me. Uh-huh. Yes, challenge. It's a challenge.
It is. I think it challenges you to sort of elevate the things that you add and to try and give everything that you put in that sense of, I think I've already used the word gravitas once before, but that sense of legacy and gravitas. Yeah. So it doesn't look like we all went into the cathedral and just stuck something new in. That it looks and feels like it was always there, so that we're not adding to this world. We're just exploring it and almost like documenting what we find so that other people can explore it after us. Everything, I think that's one of the things I've learned working with Andy. You know, he's been brilliant in saying, look, you know, this doesn't fit. You know, this isn't right. And it can be, you know, sometimes I've wanted to defend it and think, but it's great. But it's like, but it doesn't fit. And it has to fit because this is just this massive, complex machine that, you know, I may be only looking, I'm like looking through a letterbox at my bit of it. And, you know, Tim, I think, has maybe got the front door open and Andy's lived in the house.
Metaphorically.
Yes. Yeah. But I think, yeah, it isn't a restriction in the end. It's an empowering thing. So it means you have to raise your game and put things together that feel like they are, like they've always been there, like I said, but also hopefully you leave something that someone else can pick up from and do something with afterwards. You know, so you don't kind of like just, you don't finish it and go, oh, there we go. You know, you leave some bits there that someone else would come and go, oh, I can see where you were going with that. Yeah, I can go. I'll follow that bit over there and do that and try and leave some nice bits behind.
Yeah, it's a huge honour. And you talk about the privilege, their legacy of getting to write for these characters and playing that sandbox and writing dialogue for characters like Alistair, or obviously Archie in the book, I've Alistair as well, and Travers, another great character from the Web of Fee. You know, getting to write for these characters is such an honour. And you're right, Chris, you know, seeing a bit of your work come up on the TARDIS wiki, it's like amazing. It's like you have contributed to this big masterpiece, and it's just an absolute privilege.
It's a crazy thing, but, you know, I get to turn over, something's on the front chapter, you know. I've got that, and it's being part of something that, as I say, you know, all of us as kids growing up and as adults have carried on watching this thing and devoting, you know, a lot of time and energy and passion to it. It means so much to so many people. And I'm kind of living, as I say, you know, just like you with, you know, just like you guys have got your podcast now, you're doing that, you know, I'm living through that with my boys now, who are, you know, really one of them, like, super into it, keeps coming in and saying, you know, with this Doctor Who magazine, said, oh, did you know in 1973? And I've long since stopped going, yes. And let's go, nope.
I know that feeling.
No, I tell you what, if I ever get Andy round for dinner, I don't think Dan will ever let him leave. I think you'll just, we'll end up, you'll get like that fella in Misery. You'll just be kept.
What's my ankle?
That'll be it, yeah. Yeah.
We'll get Benny as well in, yeah.
In the basement.
Both of them, Andy, there you go.
The war begins.
Yeah.
What about you, Tim?
I've already noticed that my approach has changed when I've when I've been editing the unit stories. When I was writing Lethbridge Stewart for Andy, I've always been very careful to try and narrow my focus. So I know that I've got a story to tell that fits into that gap. I'm aware of everything else that's going on around, but I always try not to focus on it, not to think about it too much, because I was always concerned that I would find it difficult to home in on what I really want to, on the story that I want to tell. And knowing that Andy's got sort of sight of the wider picture. Of course, I wasn't that heavily involved with the original Benton Files book that came out some months back, but we've been pulling together the Unit Files short story collection, and suddenly I've got the world to think about, and it's been a very different experience for me, but I've really enjoyed it. I've really loved picking up other people's stories, and when I'm going through them, thinking about how they fit into this broader world, broader universe that's going on around it. And that's been a really empowering experience for me, and also trying to bring the writers along on that experience with me as well, so that they're also aware of that bigger universe where necessary as well.
Fabio, so the Unit Files then, for those who aren't aware, they're more recent. They're going further down the timeline then with like Brigadier and Benton in the kind of the period of time when it's much more established, whereas the Lethbridge Stewart books are that period between Web of Fear predominantly and Invasion. That's right, Andy, yeah?
Correct.
So, Andy, why didn't you tell us basically a bit about how the Lethbridge Stewart work came about then, how those books came about originally?
What we did, right, we got a keyboard.
And you wrote a book.
Impressive. Well done. Musical prose.
It's actually quite weird. All began in a train station in Cardiff. I was at the time selling pasties and coffee. And a semi-regular customer of mine, a guy called Daniel Vine, he worked in the job centre there. We got nattering about this and that, as you do. And Doctor Who come up, because it does. And I was created bits of Doctor Who, and he mentioned Yeti. And I was like, oh, your grandfather's Merson Haysman. Okay, yeah, and blah, blah. And he told me about, obviously, the trouble his grandfather's had with the BBC over the many, many, many years. Certainly the old BBC, I should say. And then... not to rag on the new series, but then the Snowman came on, and I noticed obviously Grey Intelligence is in it. No credit for Mervyn Haysman. So I said to Daniel, like, are you aware? Is your sister aware? Because I knew she was the executive estate of this. Well, I don't know. And Hannah's like, no, I am now. And we just got talking from there. And then it suddenly occurred to us that obviously she owns a Brigadier. And Sean suddenly thought, ooh, and we're like, oh, I see where we're going here. And then it was just pretty straightforward from that point. We had a nat with Hannah, and it got agreed, as I recall, within like a matter of weeks. And then obviously came the actual developing we're doing now. Now we've got the Brigadier, where do we tell his story? And just basically fill up 4 years gap, so let's do that. That's the obvious place to do it. And the rest is history.
Yeah, but obviously some of those are not just set in that 4 year gap between Web of Fear and Invasion as well. So you obviously you've got the Bloodline series that we all wrote for as well, and the Laughing Gnome as well. So what was the purpose behind those series?
That was mostly lethargy. and obviously we were doing the ongoing narrative, and I was just getting creatively, I was just getting tired and bored,
you know, and like with any TV show, I think once the showrunner, to use that term, has reached the end, then it's like you need to step back or get out of town, you know, let somebody else do it. So we talked about it, and it's like, right, we need to do something different before we just end up repeating ourselves, and the fact that I'm bored of it will start showing. So we, well, let's just do a series of books that are different, that deals with a different aspect of the Leopard Jewett timeline. And the Laughing Gnome concept, we'd had that in our mind for quite a while. So it seemed the opportune time to just take a step back, do something a bit different, play around a little bit, you know. And then once I'm feeling refreshed, we can go back to the narrative, which is where we're now at again. So, yeah, literally, it was just a case of, look, breaks on, or otherwise this is all going to go completely pear-shaped. And obviously, we don't want to do that.
Fair enough. So I guess, everyone, what's been your favourite story to write of the series so far, or that you haven't come out yet? But I'm not sure how much you can talk about that. So, you know.
So, Andy, you've written majority of the books. What's been your favourite story you've worked on?
Written. I've worked on every single one.
Yeah, of course. So everyone, What's the favourite book you've written, or favourite story you've written?
That is difficult. I know many people seem to think Beast of Fangrock would make sense, because obviously it's such a big sequel to a big Doctor Who story. I think for me personally, my favourite is Time of the Intelligence. No, Night of the Intelligence, sorry, not Time of Intelligence, that's a big finish. I wrote that in, I think, like 2 months, possibly less than that. I forget. It just came together really, really easily. And it was a good chance to explore stuff that I was interested in, obviously Buddhism and whatnot. And because it's set in the 70s, that's quite an important part of 70s culture at the time anyway. But yeah, everything about that book, just as one reviewer said, it was like Avengers of the Leopard Stewart reign. That was basically the culmination of, at that point, 3 years storytelling. And it could have been a disaster because there's a lot to juggle together, but it turned out to work really well. And I think it's my favourite. So, but ask me this next week. I'm sure it'll be a different book.
Oh, interesting.
So, Chris, you've written some of the Lucy Wilson as well, haven't you? That the Brigadier's granddaughter as well. So, between that and also Leslie Stewart, what's your favourite?
Probably my favorite, the one I think is probably, it's hard to compare, like the Leopard Stewart book that I did, the George Costner mystery, and the Lucy Wilson stuff, because they're very different in terms of tone, to say the least. And obviously you're writing for kind of young adult with the one, or sort of pre-young adult in certain instances, so you're definitely a younger audience, there's things you just can't do. Whereas with the George Costner mystery, within the bounds of decency, really, Andy let me pretty much do anything I wanted. He was very kind to me and said, look, you know, why don't you go over here in this pocket universe where you can't do too much damage. And then allowed me in that universe to do an incredible amount of damage to an incredibly large number of people. I remember writing that, and it took me a little bit longer because it went through, it was a sort of a bit of a difficult time. But yeah, I'm really, really pleased with that book when it came out. But probably, weirdly, the favourite thing I've written was the short story that I did for Christmas Crackers, which was originally just one of the advent calendar giveaways, because I promised it to Sean. And as Andy knows, I've got two writing speeds. I'm producing nothing because I'm tied up with other things, or I'm busy, or I'm like a rocket and I'm really quick. And I promised this thing to Sean, and he put me like down in the 20s. So I had time down the advent calendar. But, you know, as fixed deadlines go, Christmas is pretty much an immovable feast. You know, that's going to happen. And oh, my days. I had so many false starts. Like, this is what I'll do. Start writing it. No, this is awful. No. About 7 or 8 different stories that got to fair degrees of completion. But I just went, I don't hate this. I don't like it. And I can remember vividly sitting cross-legged under the Christmas tree. I'm not under it, obviously, because I'm like 6 foot one, but yeah, adjacent to the Christmas tree, surrounded by Christmas presents, on my own, like the lights down to get the maximum Christmas vibe I could. And then I blasted that out pretty much in one sentence. It's one of those things you can write and it just, you just hit your flow and even you don't know what's going to happen. And it all just magically comes out. And I still love that story now. Because it is one of my more bonkers, timey-wimey, alternate realities all crashing around and loads of weird stuff thrown in there. But yes, there's something about that one that was a real kind of like bit of, you know it when you write, you know, as writers yourselves, you know, and you hit that moment where you think, I've got no idea why I just wrote that down, but I really like it. And I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to keep going. And you're kind of on this water slide and you just go. And that's, yeah, there's just a little, for some reason, I had a little tiny bit of magic that night and a little Christmas miracle maybe. And I love that story for that reason.
Brilliant. What about you, Tim?
It's a tricky one. Because obviously I'm incredibly fond of and incredibly proud of Lucy Wilson and the Bledow Cadets because it was my first book. I'm also incredibly proud of An Ordinary Man, which I wrote with Andy, simply because there were sections of the book that I felt were the best writing that I'd done at that time. So I think probably my favorite book ought to be the last one I've done, because I find it difficult to judge one against the other. So if I didn't say Lucy Wilson, The Children of January, I'd feel like I was not letting the side down as such, but I like to think that the work I deliver is the best I can at the time. And, you know, that's where all my affections are at the time. Although I do have a real fondness for the Attack of the Quarks book that I added a couple of stories to Chris's Quark story from Lineage from a few years ago, and it was given away free with was it Kiss of the Ice Maiden, I think. Yeah. It was given away free with, and the last story in that book is called Beyond the Sunset, and it was one of those that I felt really moved by it as I wrote it, the way that Lucy and the Quark had bonded, and the way that, this is going to be a horrendous spoiler for anyone that's not read the story, but the Quark has absorbed part of Lucy's consciousness from an event that happened in the in the middle story, as it were, the Expo of Terror, and the way that works itself out as effectively as Hobo, Lucy and the Quark walk home to Ogmore from wherever they are, Bridgend, I think it is. And it's, yeah, at the end of the story, I just thought I'm really, really proud of that. I felt I'd done something that I was incredibly proud of myself, rather than worrying about what other people thought of my writing. So I think I'd pick out that short story specifically.
Oh, it ends now. I haven't read it yet.
Sorry.
I haven't read as much as you guys yet, but, you know, massive honor to work on Forward to the Past. I think in terms of my favorite stuff I've done, which is very little at the moment, is really enjoyed writing for Benton on the upcoming Unit Files short story. You know, I love the character. But I think for me, it was Forward to the Past that I worked with Andy was a real luxury, because it was two books in one. It was that kind of alternate time I have at the same time as Abominable Snowman. So it's kind of character interacting with a classic Doctor Who story, but also the kind of the Back to the Future historical style with Paris. And I think that Paris stuff I wrote, the kind of Bond 19th century Paris arc with Archie and Anne, I think was somewhat, I love writing that stuff. I really, really got into that. And some of the scenarios I put those characters through, I had a huge amount of fun writing for them.
That you've just reminded me, actually, Baz. This harks back to a question from slightly earlier, and one of the joys for me, because I didn't know what was going to happen in the rest of the Bloodlines series, because I wasn't originally going to be part of it, of course. And I'd put this almost like a throwaway moment in when Archie was in Bledo with the Zippo lighter.
Yeah.
And I, because it was something that scene needed at the time, and Andy rewrote a lot of that early section of the book because it needed it basically. It just it was considerably underwritten for certain characters, but that bit had stayed, and that was lovely. And then when both you and Chris had picked up on the lighter in your books that came after it as well, I loved that, because I got a real unaccountable thrill out of it, thinking, yeah, this is a little something I just popped it in there as like almost like a throwaway thing, and it's bled through the next couple of books. I got a real sense of cohesion about the whole thing as well. It helped bring it all together.
Okay, so Tim, you're overseeing the new Unit File series. So I guess how did that come about, and how does it quite differ from the Lethbridge Stewart novels?
Well, I will say straight off, we're at a very early stage with the Unit series at the moment. It's not there aren't going to be any Unit novels until 2023. There are some Unit books coming. Obviously, we've had the Benton Files already. There will be a Unit Files short story collection. Don't have a publication date for that yet. And that's partly, I think, to try and sort of bridge the gap slightly between the Benton Files book and audio that came out and the fact that there won't be any novels until 2023. But the whole thing came about. The whole thing came back because Andy didn't want to do it. really.
Boys, you need to accept that we're all just doing the stuff that Andy don't want to do. That's
basically.
So around Christmas, only one of us is Santa in this arrangement, I think.
You are all the elves. So,
and there's a lot of elves. A lot of elves out there dying in the mines, Andy. You need to work.
You're just cruel.
Essentially, that's it. I don't know whether discussions were had behind the scenes or anything, but Sean phoned me up one day and said, Andy doesn't want to do Unit, as it were. Would you do it instead? And I thought, wow, that's a lot to take on. And, you know, I still consider myself to be quite a new writer in many ways, although I seem to have done an awful lot over the last 3 or 4 years. But that's kind of a bit of a mindset. And I spoke to my wife and basically said, if I turn this down, I think it's going to be something I would really regret for a long time afterwards. So that's why I said yes to it, because I thought if I don't do it, then I'm going to regret it.
I'll take anything I can get on operation.
Reserve elf. Yeah. Andy, so look, probably going to want to ask questions for you as well then. So the Lethbridge Stewart books, they're kind of wrapping up then, the period of time between Web of Fear then and Invasion then. So kind of, can you kind of tease what's to come in those kind of final set of novels?
Nothing. No. Well, we've only got one year to go, which I'm about 60 pages left to edit, which is pretty good. And then we've got, hang on, let me get this right. We have got 3 novels leading up to Unit, essentially. Mm-hmm. There's one by New Gateway, which is first one out next year. Then there's one by John Peel, and then there'll be one by Jonathan Bloom, which is quite cool because I've been after him for a long time. You know, just get out there, not to kill him or anything. And then amongst those, there's 2 other novels. One, which is essentially wrapping up the whole Schizoid Earth trilogy we've been doing on and off. One more, which is wrapping up the Dominic Farr dominate a story, because obviously we need to actually explore how he finally gets written out. And then the very, 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 very final book will be written by me, if I have time. It's probably be written by Tim. You know how it's going to go, right? basically going to be a sort of in-between book, which is what me and Sean discussed, but don't mean this is how it's going to turn out. It's basically going to be the five doctors that are left for Stuart. It's basically just a little bit of a romp, getting everybody involved we can as an in-between. You know, we've got to the point where UNIT's being formed. But while all that bureaucracy is going on, this little adventure happens, and there will be UNIT, because the invasion will have happened, and so on and so on. So yeah, it's going to be some fun stuff coming up. What can I tease you about these stories? I can tease that the penultimate pre-UNIT book is called United Nations, and the final book in that series is called Intelligence Task Force.
Ah, nice.
John and John had no choice in the titles. You guys know what this is like. Yeah. How often do you get titles? I think all three of you, that you've never titled yourself. So, you know, it's part of the course.
This is true.
Absolutely.
Book that you didn't get the title of. I don't, as I recall, Chris, we give you the title too, didn't we? Of the crossing.
Yeah.
And we give Tim more than one title. It's just, you know, you give the title, what can you make of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. One way to write.
I think we negotiated Forward to the Past slightly, didn't we, Andy, on that final book of Bloodlines?
We kind of played around with it because, yeah, I always knew that Back to the Future vibe was always a big thing. So it's going to play on. But yeah, I'm trying to think what else. Nothing really. Mostly because I've not read them yet. So there's obviously stuff, you know. I mean, you guys have written for me. I, as you well know, by the time I get to editing the books that you've written, I've completely forgotten what the outline was because that was so long ago and I've worked on so many books since then. Like, I'm reading a book at the moment, editing the book, rather, and there's a few bits I'm thinking, did we agree to that? I can't remember. Did I? Email. Did we agree to this? Oh, no, I just thought it'd be, oh, okay, cool, right. Because I can't remember because these decades ago in my head, you know. So I can't give too much away because I don't know. It's as much a surprise to you as it's going to be to me, so I don't know.
We are always concerned, Andy, about you being kidnapped, you know, and people torturing you for information, so that you don't know it means you can't give it away. So that's good.
That's now official out there, yeah.
Yeah, there is no value in kidnapping Andy. Let's just make that clear.
It's Tim instead.
Yeah.
That's it, yeah.
Tim's cheers. Sorry, Tim. Lovely, thanks. Thanks for that.
Santa strikes again.
Yeah. I never signed up for that.
Well, too bad. That's why Lethbridge Stewart is ending. Andy doesn't want to have the threat of kidnap anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I should have read the small
print. Once again, we take a darker turn.
It says a dial in.
I should have read the small print. Mickey.
Tim, all I can say is you have no idea what you've let yourself in for.
This is true. Yeah, I don't think I do have any idea what I've let myself in for. So. I'll have a cattle prod by the front door.
Yeah. That's the comfort of being a boy who only works in the parallel universes. Doesn't matter what I do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Get the protection.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'm not accepting this excuse from you anymore, Lynch. I'm afraid I'm going to commission you to write something for me, and I'm going to drag you back into this universe, kicking and screaming.
Well, there's consequences then, though.
Well, have we told you about it? I don't know. I'm sure we told you about the third of the clown stories that we want you to do.
Yes. Yeah. It has been discussed.
Remember. So many stories.
Yeah. So there's lots more to come, which is absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So I think that comes to the end of our podcast. So thank you guys for coming along and chatting Doctor UNIT, Lethbridge Stewart, and some pretty twisted dark stuff there as well. We've had Sanders and nothing. So it's been a blast. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sorry about that.
no need to apologise. It's fun. Spices it up.
Brilliant. Absolutely, yeah. So if you want to find out more Doctor Who content from us at We Made This, you can find a whole host of Big Finish reviews from Ben, myself, and the rest of the team. And you can follow the TARDIS crew by checking out Crew TARDIS on Twitter and the TARDIS crew on Instagram. So thanks for joining us for another episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. A huge thanks to Andy, Chris, and Tim for coming aboard. Please subscribe to the TARDIS crew and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/wemadethis. Doctor is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in a moment. So join us again for the TARDIS crew, because somewhere there's danger, somewhere there's injustice, somewhere else the tea's getting cold.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Red and buried.
I think that with this podcast, we get to explore all the different types of things that exist within crime.
Yes.
And the genre, the only rule being it has to be in a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The literary equivalent of fast food, and I love fast food.
Well, there you go, exactly.
And yeah, it's kind of a crime within a crime and a book within a book.
A murder. Oh.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
And I think what it actually does is simple, silly, short and on brand and fits Red Dwarf. But critically, because it is an advert, it's actually effective. I got the message that it is a better idea to use the app technology over a phone call to the AA. And that's surely the job done, right?
Yeah.
I didn't think it was like roll on the floor funny, but I didn't think it was unfunny. I thought Chris Barry's performance of he was ringing, it reminded me a lot of the old bank adverts you used to get where someone would be like, oh, you're with that new bank. Well, I'm with so-and-so bank and I can ring. I'm sure that there were adverts like Brian Laurie that used to do that back in the day, or Harry Enfield.
The Barclaycard adverts with Johnny England.
That's it.
Yes.
Movieversaries.
How old were you when you sort of came across Mulholland Drive? You've been pretty young, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I watched it 2 days ago, but I haven't seen it since I was about 17 or 18.
Mm.
And I think the only reason I got into that is because I was a little film snob, but also because of the band Rammstein.
Right, they had, was it the song Rammstein in Lost Highway?
The song Rammstein was in Lost Highway, correct? But they also did a music video for some song, I can't remember what it was. It was like a burning of a car, and I remember that I watched the making of, and they just kept talking about it being Lynchian. And I was like, what does that mean?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.